Chapter 14, I'll Fly Away. October 2005. I arrived in Nairobi a little after 6 in the morning. I was in Kenya for Operation Smile, a decades-old medical charity providing reconstructive surgeries for children worldwide with cleft lips, palates, and other facial deformities that were either life-threatening or socially ostracizing. They were doing a 2-week mission providing surgeries at 3 sites in Kenya, Nairobi, Mombasa, and Nakuru. I brought my hairdresser friend Ken, who had been the one to introduce me to the charity. When I heard Operation Smile had scheduled the mission, I wanted to go along because I had made the charity a priority for me. It was October 26th, my 3rd wedding anniversary, and Nick and I had arranged to be nearly 4,000 miles apart. He was in Sweden working with producers on his album. I was in Africa. It didn't matter, really. We were barely speaking. We got there in the morning, and I had a day to myself before we took a bus west to Nakuru that night. I thought I would sleep, but I wanted to see if I could be anonymous so far away from America. I washed my face and threw on my jeans and my oversized army green jacket. I stood in the mirror wondering if another tourist would notice me. I was Jessica Simpson. I decided to pull my hair back with a black bandana the same way I had on mission trips as a kid. As I did so, I saw the shine of my wedding ring in the mirror. I looked at it and it felt suffocating and heavy on my hand. I watched myself as I slipped it off to place it in the tiny pocket of my jeans and exhaled. The ring left a line of white on my finger, and I rubbed at it, trying to make it disappear. I went to Nairobi National Park, a 45-square-mile nature preserve outside the main part of the city. I walked in through the main entrance, and I had the feeling of being on a spacewalk as I got farther and farther from the safety of the car. I felt untethered, afraid that if someone spotted me, a crowd would form, and then I would have to run. I opened my backpack to get a bottle of water and sipped nervously as I moved into the park. "Excuse me," said a woman behind me. This voice was British. "Please," I thought. "Excuse me," she said again. I turned to see an older woman with a husband who matched her to a T. She smiled. "Your bag," she said. "It's open." A wave of relief washed over me. "Thank you," I said. They kept walking, and so did I, blissfully invisible. Near the entrance, the David Sheldrick Wildlife Trust runs a sanctuary for orphaned baby elephants and rhinoceroses. As I blended in with a small crowd of people standing behind a light rope line, keepers led a dozen or so baby elephants to a mud bath. The parents of these animals are usually killed by ivory and rhino horn poachers, and the orphans are found close to death themselves. They grow up there, bottle-fed until they're old enough to be released. In the beginning, they follow us around, the keeper told us, but then they start to make their own decisions about where they want to go, and so we follow them. Usually around 2 years old, the elephants have the confidence to go back into the wild. I watch them frolic, dropping themselves on the ground and rubbing up against each other, their huge ears flapping. I took my sunglasses off so I could look them in the eyes. People slowly left the viewing area, but I stayed, transfixed. It had been so long since I had spent that amount of time alone among people. This was my sanctuary, too. I heard the click of a camera shutter like a gun cocking. It was to my left, but I didn't want to turn my face to see it. I shoved my left hand in my pocket and tried to fiddle my wedding ring onto my finger, like Houdini with a hidden key. "Come on, Jess," I said to myself. I scrunched my finger up to catch the ring with my nail. Another click. Got it. I pulled out my hand and put my sunglasses back on with my left hand to be sure my ring was in the shots. I turned just slightly to see a heavyset white man training a Canon camera on me. I was the game, and I was caught. I deadened my face, put my sunglasses on, and left the park. That night on the bus to Nakuru, I wrote in my journal and asked God to replenish my heart so I could be of use to the children coming in for screenings and surgeries the next day. I was so tired of focusing on my own sadness and anxiety. "I release this pain to you, so you will free me," I wrote. Lord, use me as I deny myself anything having to do with me. That me is denied, passed on, set aside. I meant every word, and I thought the same when I walked into the hospital the next morning. Use me, I said again to God. There were so many children, and the surgeons would perform over 150 procedures on this mission trip. I stood around and posed for photographs, knowing my job was to bring attention to the charity. The real work was done by people like Dr. Bill McGee, the pediatric plastic surgeon who co-founded the organization. And then I met Bogie. She was 18 months old, gorgeously chubby, and had come in to have surgery on her cleft lip and palate. Her mother had terrible anxiety about the procedure and had gone outside to calm down. I later learned they had traveled 12 hours to get to the hospital. She must have been so overwhelmed to work so hard to get somewhere, only to then face the fear of her baby being operated on by strangers. Bogie began to cry, and I lifted my arms to a nurse out of some instinct I didn't know I had. The nurse set her in my lap, and I smiled at her, making soothing shh sounds as I rocked my body to be one big cradle for her. She looked up, and we regarded each other for a moment. Two strangers brought together in a place unfamiliar to both of us. Look at you, I said. You're so pretty. She had the tiniest bit of short, tight curls, and as she relaxed, I couldn't help but kiss her pretty head. Her cleft lip was on the right side of her face, and the wide split went up to her nose, exposing her front teeth. We relaxed together, and people moved on from watching us. Everyone was so busy that day that Bogie and I just blended in until it was her turn. I went to give her over, and she started crying again. Dr. McGee was doing the operation himself and asked if I wanted to scrub in so I could stay with her. I nodded yes, and after I was scrubbed up and capped and gowned, I carried Bogie in myself. You're already so beautiful, I whispered to her. This will just make things easier for you. I held Bogie when they gave her anesthesia and stroked her head as she slipped off to sleep. I thought I'd leave, but Dr. McGee invited me to stay. I watched, wanting to be a witness to this miracle. It took, 45 minutes? And it would change Bogie's life forever. And mine, too. I had come to Kenya thinking I would be blessing these kids with good works, and I was the one being blessed. When it was over, Dr. McGee said he was impressed I didn't flinch once. It was one of the best reviews I've ever received. I went with Bogie to recovery so that I would be the first person she saw when she woke up. I sat cradling her and marveling that you could already see the transformation of her mouth being made whole. I held her in the crook of my right arm, and in her post-operation sleep, she wrapped her little hand around my left index finger. When she was fully awake, someone went to get her mom to tell her that the surgery was a success. She came in and we smiled at each other. She had no idea who I was and wanted nothing from me but to step in when she was in need. I hugged her, thinking how scared she must have been. The doctors worked all day, so I stayed late and did the same the next day. When it was over, Ken and I were exhausted, and I could not stop thanking him for getting me involved in Operation Smile. It gave me perspective on what mattered. I hadn't planned on doing so much soul-searching, but being so far away gave me an opportunity to look inward in stillness. As a part of the trip, we arranged to take a jeep out to the Masai Mara National Reserve to camp. As we drove farther and farther into the flat grassland, I looked out at the trees dotting the landscape here and there and felt a growing freedom. I could have been anybody to Bogie's mom. Could I be anybody to me? And who did I want to be? That night, I slept in a tent. Don't worry, it was luxury glamping. I don't want to make you think I was suddenly roughing it. I was changing, but I was still me. Still under that blanket of stars woven by God. I didn't have my usual fear of the dark and what could happen. I went to bed early, not putting it off like I usually did, and slept soundly. I dreamed something about my life in Hollywood and being chased by paparazzi. I was so grateful when the Kenyan sun woke me, safe, a world away from all that. I went outside and saw I was the first up. There had been just the lightest rain. Now the early morning sun was shining. It was so beautiful that I bowed my head to pray, thanking God for giving me clarity. I knew now what I had to do. When I opened my eyes, I looked up to the sky and saw it, a double rainbow. I know how that sounds, but it's true. And it was the confirmation I needed. I stared at it, my hands on my hips, and began to sing softly up to the sky. "If happy little bluebirds fly beyond the rainbow," I sang, "why, oh why can't I?" When I got back to America, I would make steps to start my new life. I had to escape, and I wouldn't be leaving Nick to be with anybody. I was escaping to be with myself. There's a line in my journal from that time that I kept returning to. "We must be willing to get rid of the life we've planned so as to have the life that is waiting for us." It's a quote from Joseph Campbell, who studied mythology to describe what it takes to be a hero. I probably got it from one of the many, many self-help books I devoured back then, underlining points and dog-earing the pages that seemed to tell me a way out. I repeated that quote to myself for weeks, in the shower, on a red carpet, driving in my car. There was a life waiting for me, I told myself. I owed it to the people in it to be brave. On the night of November 22nd, 2 days before Thanksgiving, I couldn't make that life wait any longer for me. "I think I want a divorce," I told Nick. I later heard that he told the press he was blindsided. I don't know how. At that point, we were not even speaking to each other. Maybe he was just shocked that I stood up for myself. I don't think he ever thought I would take the leap. He immediately tried to talk me out of leaving him, saying we should sleep on it. When I told him the next day that we should announce a separation, that seemed to make it real to him. I knew I would be disappointing so many people. He went to the studio to record a song he said he wrote the week before called "What's Left of Me." I later found out he had his camera crew record him singing the demo. That evening, I rushed through LAX to make a flight to Dallas so I could be with my family in Waco. I was dressed like I was trying to disappear. Black jeans and a black button-down with a black and white plaid newsboy cap, and the darkest, biggest sunglasses I had to hide behind. I made it to the gate as they were boarding and got out my phone. There was one more person I had to tell, my father. "Dad, I have to do it," I said. "I have to leave him." I waited to see who was going to respond, my father or my manager. "Absolutely, baby," he said. "I love you, and I'll do whatever you need me to do." That was my dad. "We should do a statement," I said. "That way I'll stick to it." "Just don't talk about it out loud," he said. "This is going to break and break hard. We need to control it." That was my manager speaking. There was no controlling this, I thought. My life was about to turn upside. "Okay," I said, "but do it right away. I'm so proud of you." And then he paused. "I wish I had the courage that you have to do that with your mom." "What?" I asked. "What are you even saying?" He didn't speak. I couldn't handle what he had just said, so I immediately shelved it. "Dad, the plane's about to take off," I said, and hung up on him. I was confused by what he said, but I put it aside because I was so overwhelmed. I settled in my seat, and it was only when we took off that I started to cry. This was before Wi-Fi on plane, so this was my last 3 hours before the storm hit. The statement went out while I was in the air, but nobody on the plane knew a thing, except that Jessica Simpson was loudly sobbing in first class. Then they announced that the movie we all had to watch was The Notebook. Oh God, I thought. The most romantic movie in the world, and I was leaving Nick. I knew exactly what the movie was about because I had read the script but turned it down because they wouldn't budge on taking out the sex scene. And it would have been with Ryan Gosling, of all people. The movie was on every screen and I was swept up into it, wishing I had that great love that would be forever. The flight attendants all felt sorry for me and I was trying so hard to be polite every time they came over with one more Kleenex. I was a total wreck. When I landed, the announcement had made the news in the airport. With my head down, I ran to a car to take me to Nana and Papa's house before anybody could find me. It was a new house my family had bought them, one that they got to build themselves to make it perfect. I got in late, and they greeted me at the door. I collapsed into their arms, safe. My parents were coming the next day on an early Thanksgiving morning flight, so it was just me and my grandparents for the night. Papa seemed uncomfortable, not sure what to say. He went to bed while Nana and I talked late in the living room. I looked up at all the framed magazine covers and articles she had hanging up of Nick and me, like the InStyle wedding photos and the Teen Vogue cover. She loved our love story and adored Nick for waiting for me. I know she prayed for him every night, and she probably still does. She was in denial that it was ending, and as much as she adored me, she was unable to hide her disappointment. "You'll sort this out," she said. "Nana, no, it's time. Pray on it. It's God's will that you be married." My heart broke just a little more. "He's not really a Christian," I told her, "and I'm not being the wife he deserves. What about this marriage is godly?" "Well, divorce isn't godly," she said. I paused, realizing my grandmother, my prayer warrior, thought I was doing wrong in God's eyes. I closed my eyes for a second and took her hand. "Nana, this is the decision God wants me to make. It's not godly to stay together to be completely unhappy." She looked off. I knew she had stayed through Papa's struggles with drinking, but clearly she loved him and saw the man he truly was. The Papa I got to grow up with. My mother had stayed in a marriage with my father, who also apparently wanted out. Everybody just stayed, stuck it out, thinking God would close his eyes to them if we dared to ask, "What about me?" Sure enough, when my mother arrived, she hung on to her natural inclination that if you just worked at something enough, you will get the results you want. She waited until a quiet moment to give in to that southern impulse to smile and get through it. "Just give it another shot," she said. "Mom, you sound like your mom," I said. I knew that would sting, but I couldn't help myself. Like all mothers and daughters, especially strong-willed, dynamic ones, they too have a complicated relationship. I know I'm breaking Nick's heart, my family's heart, hell, the world's heart. "You are America's couple," she said. My mom said it like she was seeing everything in a different way than me. This wasn't just some feel-good celebrity ranking. It was that in many ways we belong to the public. She is a smart businesswoman, and she knew more than I did how many people might turn on me. "What is the point in being a power couple if we're faking it?" I said. "There's no real power in this anymore. Real power is in authenticity." She nodded and took my hand. She loved Nick, but she supported me. At the Thanksgiving table, we talked about what we were thankful for. When it was my turn, I didn't immediately speak, and my mother started to talk to smooth it over. Silently, I thanked God for the strength he gave me to lead the life I had planned, to find the life waiting for me. "Thank you," I thought, and still do. "Thank you, thank you, thank you." I hid in Waco for a couple days, but paparazzi and reporters found me. My mom and I were on a walk, and they took pictures and asked questions like we were friends. "Jessica, why did you leave Nick?" they asked as I turned to walk back to the house. I refused to answer. I told my dad I didn't want to talk to the press at all. I will not allow for anything to come from my mouth that is disparaging to Nick or my marriage, I said. They will not get me on tape talking about it, that's it. I wasn't naive. I knew that I had opened my marriage up to the world as a fishbowl. People were going to be angry about me putting up a sign saying the exhibit was closed. I returned to L.A. and stayed at my parents' house in Encino. I was a prisoner there with helicopters circling. My sister Ashley lived behind my parents at the time, and one morning I called her. I had this idea to army crawl up and over to her house to escape without being seen. "Is that crazy?" I asked. "Yes," she said, laughing. "You must." "I wish we had walkie-talkies," I said. "Okay, meet me out back." Halfway across the yard, I heard a helicopter and stopped. I wondered if it was worth it. I could have just stayed in the marriage, and at least I wouldn't be crawling through the dirt to my little sister's house. No, I've got this, I said aloud. I cleared the hill and saw the glass and concrete of her home. Ashley was waiting for me at the back door, and she hugged me when I jumped up and ran in. She laughed when I realized I got the dust of the California Valley all over myself. Can I borrow some clothes? I asked. We went upstairs and we spent the day laying on the floor, our heads touching as we listened to music and talked. She would make amazing playlists, almost like medicine. I think this song applies to your life right now, she'd say, my emotional DJ. It had been so long since we had hung out. I needed her strength as I mourned, and we became so much closer through my divorce. It took me losing part of my life to appreciate a part of my life that always will be, my sister. You're going to be okay, she would say. Just give it time. But I had to work. On December 5th, I was scheduled to perform at a Christmas gala at Cincinnati Music Hall, right in Nick's adopted hometown. A local billionaire named Carl Lindner was famous for his lavish holiday parties and had done a deal with my dad to pay me nearly $1 million to sing for one night in the city where everyone loved Nick. Casey went with me, and I dressed in all black because I thought I needed to be somber for the crowd who I was certain would hate me. Just before going on, I froze. I can't go out there, I said. Jessica, said Casey, starting with the big sister tone. Don't you be doing this here. I don't have anything to sing about, I said, hearing my introduction. I can't sing love songs. Then sing about Christmas, she said, handing me the mic. I walked on, hit my spotlight, and waited for the boos. They didn't come. It was just a quiet uncertainty. I'm sorry, I said into the mic. I started to cry and then walked off. Casey stepped forward and grabbed my face with that U shape of her hand. You get back out there. No one wants me without Nick. You were singing before you met Nick, Jessica, she said, physically turning me to push me back on stage. Remember that. I think Casey was afraid if I didn't get back out there and walk through the fear, I would never get on stage again. I sang some of my songs, but then hit my stride with the Christmas songs. I wiped the tears away during What Child Is This, thinking about all the times I sang that song in churches in Texas. When I got to O Holy Night, I turned a corner in the concert and in my life. It was during that line I love, when Christ appears and the weary soul feels its worth. That thrill of hope, I felt it. I looked out and saw that people were crying with me. I could do this life without Nick because I would never be alone. 2 weeks into December, Nick still thought we could have our whole life back. I was afraid to see him, knowing his fear of change would make me relent. I thought that if I officially moved out, just took my journals and the clothes I wanted to keep, he would understand this was real. It was my mother's idea that we would go to our house and move me out while he was away. Some boys' trip or event, I can't remember. The Simpsons were not good with conflict at the time. I admit it was rude, and Casey told me as much. She was still so close to Nick and saw him as sort of a sibling. I just think this is the wrong way to go about it, she said over and over. My mom had an empty party rental truck brought to the house because a U-Haul would be too obvious. I got about 8 of my girlfriends together, and I went over with the intention of only getting the things that were sentimental to me. I entered my house, and it was more like a haunted mansion than ever. I didn't even want to turn too many lights on. I just wanted to get in and get out. Daisy came and greeted me, jumping up and down as I bent to kiss her. Daisy May, I said, scooping her up in my arms. Once we were inside, my mom saw how little I wanted to take. She was shocked. She knew how hard I worked in my life to afford some of these things, and she didn't want her baby taken advantage of. She said, "Are you sure you don't want... Mom, we are not shopping my house." I didn't want any of it. I never wanted to see that couch again or the china we picked for our wedding. But there were some things she felt I had paid for, and I saw them carrying them out the door. I shook my head, but I was too mentally exhausted to fight. Even now, I sometimes think about some object and think, now where did that go? And I have to remind myself it was just another thing I let go of. But there was something, someone who was coming with me. At the door, I just couldn't put Daisy down. Let's go, I whispered in her ear. I turned off the light, shut the door, and didn't look back. Divorce is messy. I know he came home and was furious. Nick felt like he'd been robbed, and I know he told someone. She even took my damn dog. I wish we were the kind of people who could divorce and stay friends. We weren't, and I regret that my actions hurt him. Despite his anger, and maybe because of it, he was still intent on not letting me go. On December 15th, I called Nick to tell him I was about to file for divorce and he needed to sign the papers. The next afternoon, he drove to my parents' house where I was living. He came in and we sat on the couch. He tried talking to my parents, getting them to rethink things, but I asked them to leave. This was my decision. It's not over, he said. It is over, I said. You have the papers in front of you. I'm not signing them, he said. He promised that he would go to counseling now and sputtered how he had the number of the best counselor in Los Angeles. You didn't go when we needed it. I'll go, he said. I'll go now. I'll change. No, you won't, I said softly. I didn't want to hurt him more. He didn't like me, so I didn't understand what it was he was trying to save. And I don't even want you to. Nick, I'm continuing to change, so I don't even know who you're going to get. But it's not going to be the girl I used to be. He started to cry, and in that moment, I left my body for a second and just saw the scene. Nick in tears and this girl keeping a poker face like a hostage eyeing the door. Jessica, you should cry, I told myself. I thought it would make him feel better. I couldn't. I'd been living with sadness so long that I was used to the feeling. Please don't leave me, he said. And I was back in my body, looking into his eyes. I love you so much. Love is not enough, I said. If love was enough, I would stay forever. But it isn't enough. We have to like each other. We have to be friends. He walked out, and I slammed my fist against the couch. I had expected to be sad, and instead I was seized by anger. At Nick and at myself for not thinking I was worth doing this sooner. I thought my soul was held captive and I had the key the whole time. I filed that day, citing irreconcilable differences. Soon after, I moved from my parents' house into the first place I ever thought of as mine and home. The first time I saw it, I walked into a courtyard with flagstone terracing, and the house had ivy climbing the walls. I feel like I'm in Hansel and Gretel, I said. I was told by the realtor it was a starter mansion, which made me laugh. To me, it was a storybook house, an enchanted cottage with a secret garden and a pond with lily pads. When I walked inside, it felt like a hug, and I let the house embrace me. I bought it on the spot. I finally had my own home and nobody else's. I didn't have to share it with the world or camera crews, my parents or a man. It was mine. It was in Beverly Hills on Coldwater in a gated community. It felt safe and it made sense that I was surrounded by high-profile single women who were also in transition and finding themselves. Nicole Kidman, Penelope Cruz, and Cameron Diaz. It made the gate a paparazzi resting place, but inside, we ladies at the canyon were free. I had virtually no furniture, and in the beginning, I slept on a mattress on the floor. I was alone and wanted to keep it that way for a while. My first night there, I sat on the floor by one of the glass doors to the balcony overlooking the backyard. I looked out at the full moon while I sipped on white wine. Daisy was sleeping on the mattress, tired from exploring the new place. Near me were a pile of my journals, and I pulled out the ones I used to plan my wedding. I leafed through it, smiling at the hopeful 21-year-old girl who was excited to be engaged, already making notes about bridesmaid gifts. The last pages from the journal, the beginning of my marriage, were blank. I stopped writing in that particular one because as soon as I got married, I was already different than the naive girl who took copious notes about cake testings and flower arrangements. I thought she was silly and had blamed her for rushing to get married. Now my heart went out to her. I grabbed a pen, and in words made swirly and flowery by wine and tears, I wrote on the very last page of that girl's journal. "Old journal, new life," I wrote. "Married, divorced. Love, love lost. I'm lost, yes. But believe in this moment that I will be found. Found by me. I need to outgrow passing time pretending womanhood and actually find the woman waiting. Acknowledge that she resides deep in me, but I haven't met her. I move only by faith and the strength you give me to introduce us. It's a full moon, and I forgive myself and the girl I was with this moonlight. I'm sad, but happy with the new day and the wonderful sun that will come." It did. Whatever you are going through, the sun will come.